Hi, my name is Paul Ingram. I'm a writer and a former massage therapist in Vancouver, Canada. To learn more about me, go to painscience.com/bio. Pain Science is a website about sensible advice for aches, pains, and injuries. I've written hundreds of free articles and several books about common pain problems, readable enough for everyone, but heavily referenced for pros. This article is one of several audio versions of the largest and most popular articles on painscience.com. To see the complete list available, see painscience.com/audio. A major feature of Pain Science is that I constantly update, correct, improve, and add to every important article over the years, and so audio versions steadily get out of sync with the canonical versions. This version was recorded in early 2019. This entire article is 16,000 words, so it needs a little summarizing before we start. This is just a couple of quick paragraphs explaining the point of the whole thing, and then I'll get on with all 16,000 words after that. Structuralism is the excessive focus in musculoskeletal medicine on crookedness or mechanical problems in the body, what I call the biomechanical boogeyman. It is the source of much bogus diagnosis, things like tilted pelvises, short legs, abnormal spinal curvatures, or misaligned anything. And it's the cause of much therapeutic barking up the wrong tree. Although such factors do sometimes matter, they are collectively much less important than many professionals still believe, and it tends to overshadow many other important biological and neurological considerations. Structuralism has been challenged by many medical researchers and experts, and many key scientific studies over the years have undermined major structuralist assumptions. It's a simplistic old paradigm that needs to be replaced with a more nuanced model of what causes and complicates aches, pains, and injuries. Okay, that's the summary. Let's move on with all 16,000 words of detail. Introduction. Almost everyone who's ever been to any kind of physical therapist or doctor for a stubborn pain in their body, some injury-like breakdown, has been told that they are deformed and fragile. Not in those words exactly, but that's the take-home message. Just as acupuncturists can be counted on to blame most problems on a blockage of chi, freelance manual therapists in particular tend to blame pain on mechanical or structural problems. Do they really, though? The prevalence of this proclivity will be discussed a bit further along. And by manual therapists, who I'm talking about mostly, I mean the three professions most likely to use their hands for therapy: physical therapists, chiropractors, and massage therapists. The mechanical and structural problems that I'm talking about include, but are not limited to, tilted pelvises, short legs, pinched nerves, fallen arches and pronation, weak core strength, uneven patellar tracking, fascial distortions, spinal or sacroiliac joints that are out, minor spinal curvatures, scoliosis, excessively flat or curved neck or low back, bad posture and ergonomics, tight structures like a tight IT band, shoulder dyskinesis, bad shoulder movement, cranial suture misalignments and immobility, and a long list of more technical-sounding problems such as tibial torsions, steep Q angles, and many more absurd examples. Some of these things, in some circumstances, may well be valid. For instance, I have a minor but definite deformity in my right foot that has caused me some pain. But the scientific evidence clearly shows that the importance of most biomechanical problems has been greatly exaggerated. There are at least five major problems with these kinds of diagnoses. Number one, not only are structural explanations for pain generally unsupported by any scientific evidence, but the last 25 years of research results mostly undermines them, often impressively. Number two, professionals can rarely agree on them, poor diagnostic reliability. Number three, most structural diagnoses are difficult or impossible to do anything about, even if you can agree on them in the first place. And number four, patients are often given the alarming idea that the slightest crookedness is serious and may require expensive therapy to correct. And finally, number five, biomechanics is obscuring more useful new ways of looking at how pain works. To understand injuries and pain problems and to recover from them more effectively, both patients and professionals need to try to stop thinking of the body as a machine that breaks down and start thinking more in terms of squishy, messy physiology, especially neurology and biochemistry, and even messier psychology and lifestyle factors. Curveballs like medications, side effects, and subtle pathologies are major drivers of pain. Exhaustion, emotional distress, smoking, and being really out of shape are all more important risk factors for pain than any typical misalignment has ever been. And then there's the way chronic pain seems to be a disease in its own right, and the bizarre phenomenon of central sensitization basically turning up the volume on all pain. Pain itself is much weirder and more useful to understand its volatility, its inherent unpredictability, than the many mechanical glitches that supposedly cause it. Just a couple of footnotes to the introduction before I move on, and this will be a convention throughout the audio article rather than interrupting the main text to read interesting footnotes. I will save them for the end of the section. In the web version, it makes sense to click on footnotes and see what else I have to say about something, but it tends to make the out loud version rather tedious and hard to follow if I keep going on these multi-paragraph footnote diversions. So here's a couple of selected footnotes from the first section. Regarding the foot thing, my foot deformity, it's a 4-foot varus, which means that the front of my foot is twisted away from the midline. It's minor and it's subtle, but it's also unambiguous. As soon as I could walk, I did so with my right foot turned out. The first time my parents took me cross-country skiing when I was just a tiny lad, about 4 years old, I had trouble keeping my right ski in the track. It just kept popping out, which was kind of pathetic and cute. The problem remained undiagnosed for 30 years and was finally identified by a podorthist. Basically, the whole big toe side of my foot is lifted up, so the easiest way for me to get it down for push-off is to rotate my entire leg out. It's interesting in three ways. First, how many therapists I'd seen over the years who were obsessed with fixing my posture and biomechanics but totally missed my one obvious actual deformity. Second, it's interesting how little it really affects me. It's chronic mild pain only. And third, it's interesting how impossible it is to do anything about it anyway. I tell the story of my funky foot in more detail in my plantar fasciitis tutorial, but it is a really great story and important for this article because I live with a structural deformity that actually causes me pain. So I really want readers to know that I'm not just knee-jerk against structuralism. I get it that sometimes things are wrong with the structure of the human body that actually do matter. I lived it. But at the same time, it's a pretty good instructive story about how little it matters. Okay, just one more note on the introduction. I mentioned subtle pathologies and medication side effects as being a driver of pain more than structure. What do I mean by that? What do I mean by subtle pathologies? Here's a few examples. The channelopathies, dysautonomia from subtle and intermittent myelopathy, the hypermobility spectrum disorders and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, almost clinically invisible often, and yet strongly linked to aches and pains, vitamin D deficiency, magnesium deficiency, analgesic rebound, inflammaging, possibly excessive due to metabolic syndrome or many other factors, and so on and on and on. Biology and pathology is deep. However much we think we've got a grip on it, there's always more. The list of possibilities is almost endless. Structuralism and the biomechanical boogeymen. The word structuralism is my own term for the excessive focus, not ordinary amount of focus, but too much, paying way too much attention in the physical therapies on postural and biomechanical factors in pain problems. The biomechanical boogeyman, the physical quirks that people fear as sources of pain and injury. In its most simplistic and absurd form, structuralism fixates on just one or two biomechanical factors as the wellspring of most or all pain. Here's one extreme example. I know of a therapist who earnestly believes that the stability of one tiny bone, the cuboid bone, a foot bone the size of a sugar cube, is the key to all pain and its relief. That may be an extreme example, but it's actually identical in spirit to a much more popular one. Morton's toe, a condition in which the big toe is unusually short, is often blamed for widespread body pain. These kinds of theories about the cause of pain get even stranger. I know of another therapist who believes that he has identified the source of all pain, his words, namely a consistent pattern of postural dysfunction that is allegedly caused by, wait for it, Coriolis force, of all things. Coriolis force is the effect of the spin of the earth on currents in the ocean and atmosphere. It's the cause of the direction that storms spin, but not of the direction of water circling a drain. That's a myth. It doesn't work on small scales. It doesn't work on human bodies, for instance. This guy told me with a straight face that this pattern of dysfunction caused by Coriolis force, quote, should be the opposite down under. This is absurd stuff. It's all flat-out nonsense. Cuboid bones and Morton's toe and Coriolis force acting on our posture are not important causes of pain. They're probably not causes of pain at all. But structuralism definitely is not just for health professionals with the weakest and strangest ideas. Many orthopedic surgeons, physiatrists, and sports medicine specialists are also very keen structuralists. Most chiropractors are structuralists pretty much by definition. The great majority of physical therapists and massage therapists are inclined to structuralism. The functional movement screen, that's capitalized, TM, trademarked, is an extremely conventional and popular method of, quote, effortlessly identifying asymmetries and limitations, close quote, which is routinely used and abused to justify treatments, a perfect example of structuralism right in the middle of the mainstream. These professionals are definitely not all united, and they all subscribe to many different flavors of structuralism. For instance, many doctors disdain chiropractic-flavored structuralism, but in place of poorly defined chiropractic intervertebral subluxations, physicians ironically put forward their own more scientifically respectable biomechanical factors. But while doctorly structuralism is less anti-scientific in tone and substance than a lot of chiropractic philosophy, unfortunately, that doesn't mean it's any more correct. Just as the manual therapies are infested with all kinds of biomechanically inspired treatments, so too there has been an epidemic of dubious orthopedic surgeries to correct every imaginable kind of structural problem. Different expressions of structuralism. I will show in this article that most structuralism is barking up the wrong tree. This isn't a scholarly article, but it is heavily referenced. There's a lot of citations to credible and interesting scientific research, linked and summarized. And that, of course, is all in the web version, not in the audio version, because audio citations are really boring. So, no audio citations, but I do have a few footnotes to this section. Going back to Morton's toe, I want to be clear that this idea is out there. It has been touted by Janet Travell of Trigger Point fame, and that's gonna get an idea being spread around. It's also then repeated by Amber Davies in a very popular book about trigger points, and by at least one book by a podiatrist, and then repeated ad nauseum by professionals who have read these books and followed these people. A little more about the Coriolis force thing. I already mentioned that it doesn't work on small scales. I want to be very clear about that, just in case you need to know exactly how ridiculous this Coriolis thing is. It's a macroscopic effect, the Coriolis effect. It does not have a visible effect on small systems like water going down a drain. Quote, The Coriolis force is so small that it plays no more role in determining the direction of rotation of a draining sink than it does the direction of a spinning CD. And that's from a page about bad Coriolis science. The idea that Coriolis force would be relevant to the human body is about as airheaded as you can get. Way far out in left field. Okay, just one more footnote to this section regarding FMS, functional movement screen. Note that the website for FMS has a lot of marketing and promotional language and generally makes FMS sound amazing. However, in principle, FMS is not intended to be a diagnostic tool. Officially, it shouldn't be used to identify things that are wrong with people. It's only in practice that it tends to actually get used that way as a tool of structuralism. Dire warnings: using structuralism to frighten patients into paying for therapy. A patient once gravely informed me, as if sharing a dangerous secret, that a chiropractor had predicted his back pain by identifying a minor leg length difference 10 years earlier. That prediction had been a clear warning: get your short leg fixed, or else you'll be laid low by low back pain for sure. A prediction like that is about as insightful as predicting death, taxes, or the rising of the sun. Back pain is one of the most common afflictions in the world. An impressive 90% of all people will have an episode of acute back pain at some point in their lives, whether they have a short leg or not. You really cannot go wrong predicting that someone's going to have back pain. The warning is the most common way that structuralism can do harm. It is often part of the sales pitch for a structural diagnosis. It simultaneously offers clients a pleasingly simplistic explanation for their pain, and yet it also manages to frighten patients into paying for therapy for the wrong reasons. Much worse, and ironically, it can probably frighten them right into a real pain, or pain chronicity in some cases, via a nocebo effect, the opposite of a placebo. Placebo, of course, is a belief-powered relief from symptoms. A nocebo is the opposite, belief-powered symptoms, or the placebo effect's malevolent Mr. Hyde, as Gareth Cook wrote. Nocebo is Latin for I shall harm, which would make a great supervillain slogan. Give someone a sugar pill and then convince them you actually just fed them a deadly poison and you will probably witness a robust nocebo effect. A common funny-if-it's-not-you nocebo in general medicine is the terror of beets in the toilet. People eat beets, and then they think that there's blood in the toilet, and call 911. Nocebo is a real thing, and not to be messed with. It is one of the chief hazards of excessive X-raying and MRI scans, for instance, showing people hard evidence of problems that often aren't actually a problem. A screening test that reveals alleged problems might do it, too. The course of back pain is remarkably sensitive to stress and anxiety. So when you tell people that there's some simple thing wrong with them causing their pain, there is real potential for trouble. The prevalence of scare tactics like this is why I originally coined the term biomechanical boogeymen. To wrap up this section, a quote from reader Harry M. is a good example of a scare tactic that Harry didn't believe, fortunately. I remember how annoyed I was at the fact that this Rolfer thought he knew what was wrong with me. He told me to stop walking like an old man, like I was just assuming some contorted posture when I could be standing straight and tall if I just decided to, like I'd become that way because I'd started to think of myself as an old man and so became one. He literally believed that. Fortunately, I didn't. Ka-ching, it pays to pathologize. Most of the boogeymen exist so that freelancer therapists have something to therapize, a problem to solve for a fee. With low to zero diagnostic reliability, diagnoses like shoulder dyskinesia, which is just fancy talk for bad shoulder movement, are clinically trivial and have more to do with sounding good than actually knowing anything helpful. so a professional can stare at your shoulder for a while and wisely declare, "Well, there's your problem," as though it were obvious to an expert. And if a therapist can't identify a problem to solve, why even show up? That's what most people are paying for. The pressure to cough up an easily understood premise for therapy is immense. I was a freelance therapist myself for a decade, a massage therapist in private practice, so I feel entitled to comment on how profit can corrupt healthcare. I don't think it's wrong to charge people to try to help them, but it can also be highly corrosive to professional integrity. Profitable recommendations and good healthcare are rarely the same thing. It is every healthcare professional's highest ethical responsibility not to confuse them, but they often fail. This is an extremely cynical viewpoint, of course, but I can't overstate how common it is for therapists to make the entire treatment encounter revolve around the idea of identifying and exorcising structural flaws, and how strongly and literally patients buy into that kind of therapy. For instance, an acquaintance of mine described in reverential detail just such an appointment. After a minor accident, she had normal shoulder movement and no shoulder pain, but was delighted to have paid for an osteopath to identify and fix an allegedly dislocated shoulder. No real problem to solve, but that freelance therapist identified one anyway, solved it, charged for it, and the customer was not just satisfied, but impressed. My acquaintance was actually excited to show me her new, quote-unquote, improved shoulder range of motion, and that's how potent a sales pitch the structuralist diagnosis can be. Countless times I've listened to patients tell stories about such overtly nonsensical biomechanical diagnoses, almost brainwashed by structuralists. And if someone without pain is satisfied with that, imagine how shut up and take my money people can get when given a tidy mechanistic explanation for serious chronic pain. Promised to fix, they will eagerly believe that their severe pain is the consequence of a subtle alignment problem, often so subtle that you couldn't measure it with a goniometer or get any two therapists to spot it. Nobody older than 30 would be able to walk if such trivial defects could really wreak such havoc. People who have terrible body pain problems often have perfect posture and good ergonomics, low postural stress, and healthy joints, bodies that are basically in great condition. Meanwhile, many people with perfectly obvious biomechanical problems, everything from significant scoliosis to obesity, are doing just fine, thank you very much. For instance, a 2012 study clearly showed that the severity of people's pain simply did not match up with the severity of their joint degeneration. That inconsistency in the literature is so glaring that it's puzzling that so many professionals seem to ignore it. Why? How can they miss it? Simple. Unfortunately, it pays to miss it. It pays to have structural villains to go after. It pays to pathologize. Just a couple of footnotes on that section. First, regarding how strongly and literally patients buy into structuralist therapy, there's a relevant study which found that ordinary people were more satisfied with bogus neuroscience talk than experts were. In other words, less educated folks are somewhat more likely to swallow fancy-sounding bullshit. I believe bogus biomechanics talk is even more persuasive to non-experts than neuroscience babble. Although neuroscience is used to explain pain more often than it used to be, explaining pain in terms of biomechanics still rules in most therapy offices in the land. Patients easily understand levers and misalignment. They don't question it. They don't even want to. Explaining pain with neuroscience is a way tougher sell. If you don't do it just right, it comes off as a complicated version of all in your head, which it's definitely not. If patients are able to accept bogus neuroscience explanations for pain, I guarantee they are much more willing to accept bogus structural explanations. Finally, I'd like to defend my use of the word brainwashed. I actually don't think that it's an unreasonable accusation to say that people are almost brainwashed by structuralists, even though it's a very melodramatic word choice. Patients with great anxiety, pain, and frustration are especially vulnerable to persuasion or therapy by charisma. This is why I really make an effort in my work to be reassuring without offering miracles, to be knowledgeable without claiming to absolutely know what the problem is. All too often, patients in pain will cling to whatever ideas you throw at them, so you have to be careful what you throw at them. Structuralists rarely seem to show such restraint, and consequently, patients emerge from therapy with structuralists feeling much too sure of their diagnosis. And there's no zealot like a convert. In this context, clinicians are more like clergy than healthcare professionals. Defining normal narrowly. Clinicians fail to notice the inconsistency because they think that they need something to fix so that they can get paid for fixing it. If the definition of normal was widened, as it should be, because there's really an incredible range of healthy anatomy, then there would be a lot less to fix. There would be fewer problems to diagnose, less to seem wise and knowing about, and less therapy to recommend to the customer. Natural biomechanical diversity undermines clinical mojo. But strange, wonderful, and problematic anatomical variations occur in humans all the time. Over the years, I've collected a bunch of interesting examples relevant to musculoskeletal medicine. So it's not in the best interest of therapists to normalize patients and describe their anatomical quirks as harmless, but the opposite. It's better for egos and incomes to define normal narrowly and place the blame for pain on anything that sticks out, literally or figuratively, giving naive customers the impression of cleverness for identifying the root cause of the trouble. Upton Sinclair famously wrote that it is difficult to get a man to understand something when his job depends on not understanding it. That quote couldn't possibly be more applicable here. Adapted slightly, it's difficult to get a therapist to understand that structural abnormality is rarely meaningful when his job depends on ignoring that data and actually emphasizing structure. And, of course, there's also just good old confirmation bias. Once you start mentally leaning towards the idea of asymmetries as a major cause of pain, you start noticing and emphasizing only the cases that seem to confirm that expectation, and ignoring the ones that contradict it. Healthcare is so chock-a-block with puzzles that it's effortless to write off anything that doesn't confirm your bias as an inexplicable oddity. You can even claim humility, shrug, confess I don't know, even as you conveniently dismiss data that could have taught you something. The basic problem with structuralism is that biomechanical factors have surprisingly little to do with pain problems. The two things correlate poorly. But structuralism is deeply embedded in our cultural consciousness, and we cling to the idea that aligned and symmetrical must be the best way to be. And we suffer in proportion to our deviations from that diagram. That equation makes intuitive sense to us, and we're just not going to give it up easily. Part 2, the case against structuralism. The next couple sections are going to be really full of citations, footnotes, and it'll be awkward at best to try to cram all of those into the audio version or even to return to them at the end of each section because most of them are pretty dry, just bibliographic information. The average footnote in the next stretch is a citation to a specific paper highlighting a quote or two from the paper. So in most cases, it's probably not too important to review those, but I'll be clicking madly back and forth, looking at different things as I read, picking and choosing what to elaborate on. So unless I go to a really extraordinary effort to smooth this all out and polish it, there could be a little jankiness in the next sections. So the case against structuralism starts by not taking my word for it, for goodness sakes. There's a lot of hard evidence and the most expert possible opinions to back me up. It's not an extreme position to defend. I don't need to convince you that both baby and bathwater should be thrown out together. My work here is really done if I can just convince you that there's reasonable doubt that biomechanics are a major factor in most pain. So let's start with the expert support which there is a lot of, structuralism has been shunned by many medical researchers and experts. For instance, San Francisco orthopedic surgeon Dr. Scott Dye has written eloquently about how ill-advised structuralism is when it comes to knee pain. In a 2005 paper, he says, "The fundamental issue at the core of the patellofemoral pain problem, in this author's view, has been the limited conceptualization of the genesis of anterior knee pain to that of a pure structural and biomechanical perspective. Such an intellectually constrained view does not include the complex pathophysiologic factors that may be of etiologic significance in living symptomatic joints." So some very strong expert support there, quite robust. A.L. Letterman, a UK osteopath, wrote a particularly persuasive article criticizing the postural structural biomechanical model. It's an article much like this one, in fact, just more academic and technical. For balance, I'll also be citing some extensive rebuttals to that article published in the Journal of Bodywork and Movement Therapies in 2011. Foot, shoe, and orthotics expert Benno Nigg wrote a whole book about how poorly structuralism has stood up over time. In a 2011 paper, The Modernization of Manipulative Therapy, Australian physiotherapist Max Zussman writes, "Research indicates that despite physiotherapists' comprehensive training in the basic sciences, manipulative, currently musculoskeletal therapy is still dominated in the clinical setting by its original, now obsolete, structure-based biomedical model." Back pain experts Drs. Richard Dale and Nikolai Bogduk have virtually devoted their careers to teaching doctors not to overestimate the importance of biomechanical factors in back pain. Bogduk writes concisely, "Degenerative disc disease conveys to patients that they're disintegrating, which they're not. Moreover, disc degeneration, spondylosis, and spinal osteoarthrosis correlate poorly with pain and may be totally asymptomatic." Dr. John Sarno's career has also been about debunking structuralism in back pain. He may, in fact, have gone too far down that road, but nevertheless, that's what his career has been about. In 1984, he first wrote, "There's probably no other medical condition which is treated in so many different ways and by such a variety of practitioners as back pain. Though the conclusion may be uncomfortable, the medical community must bear the responsibility for this, for it has been distressingly narrow in its approach to the problem. It's been trapped by a diagnostic bias of ancient vintage, and most uncharacteristically has uncritically accepted an unproven concept that structural abnormalities are the cause of back pain." And that is from his quite famous book, Mind Over Back Pain, about which there is much I like and much I hate. If not structure, then what? And who says that? Neurology and neuropathy, homeostasis, subtle pathology, biological vulnerability. There are all kinds of tissue issues that may have little or nothing to do with structure, alignment, and biomechanics at all. Who says about these alternatives to structuralism as a paradigm is such a long list that it can't be meaningfully narrowed down. You could include any researcher who's ever identified anything that goes wrong and causes trouble and pain that is not structural or biomechanical in nature. For instance, in 2011, biologist Paul Koobs published a great example of fascinating evidence that inflammation may become chronic due to a glitch in human immune systems. Or consider the Japanese researchers who have probably finally explained how exercise soreness works, basically neurological growing pains. Or you could look at Robert Sapolsky's entire body of work on the subject of the biology of stress and its clinical relevance to anxiety, depression, insomnia, and how those all contribute to chronic pain. Or Dr. Michael Hollick's crusading on the topic of vitamin D deficiency. Even if it's not clear that he's right, it's an interesting possibility and we'd be foolish to ignore it. Or the major contributions to the science of fibromyalgia by Drs. Fred Wolf and Daniel Clow. Or the other Wolf, Dr. Clifford Wolf, who has contributed so much to our understanding of central sensitization. And so on and on and on. There are many potential mechanisms of pain that have little or nothing to do with posture, alignment, and structure, and an army of researchers and other experts who have been pushing beyond that very limited view of how pain works. But I'll continue with a couple more important examples. Sassy Aussie pain researcher Dr. Lorimer Mosley has been doing excellent research and outreach on this topic for years now, constantly encouraging clinicians to understand pain not as an inevitable consequence of biomechanical stresses and tissue trauma, but as an output of the brain, strongly affected by many considerations, many of which have nothing to do with issues in tissues. In particular, quote, "The evidence that tissue pathology does not explain chronic pain is overwhelming, for example, in back pain, neck pain, and knee osteoarthritis. And if pain chronicity can't even be explained by tissue pathology in these common conditions, it's not very likely that subtle biomechanics can fill in that blank. This perspective has been spreading like wildfire." Doctors Janet Travell, David Simons, and Siegfried Mense all made significant scientific contributions towards understanding the more subtle and complex alternatives to structuralism, especially the ways that muscle might hurt more or less spontaneously due to neurological and/or metabolic dysfunction. It's not entirely clear. Perhaps causing a lot of the chronic pain that would normally be attributed to biomechanical boogeymen. Simons in particular wrote extensively and passionately about the neglect of muscle as a source of pain. Quote, "Muscle is an orphan organ. No medical specialty claims it. As a consequence, no medical specialty is concerned with promoting funded research into the muscular causes of pain, and medical students and physical therapists rarely receive adequate primary training in how to recognize and treat myofascial trigger points." Okay, just a couple of footnotes on that section. I mentioned Paul Koobs' research. Really interesting. I just want to share it here because I think it's so cool. His research showed that immune cells, neutrophils, unnecessarily swarm sterile injury sites, causing damage and pain with no known or likely benefit as a trade-off. It appears to just be a clear error. They have mistaken mitochondria for a foreign organism, a legacy of ancient evolutionary history and a biological glitch with profound implications about why some painful problems are so severe and stubborn. And then, of course, I can't mention trigger points without heavy disclaimering. Obviously, this topic has become very controversial over the last few years. But in this context, I don't want to focus on whether or not trigger point science is half-baked or fully baked or not at all baked. And just point out that it is nevertheless an interesting and important alternative to looking at pain as a mechanical problem. If there's anything to the science of trigger points, and I believe that it is a legitimate ongoing controversy, then it definitely constitutes an interesting alternative to structuralism and an important one. The scientific evidence that structuralism is a failed paradigm. This is a long section. Lots of references here, many footnotes and citations. I'll read some of them and skip over others. I'm going to start with a quote, though, from Nick Tumanello. This is from an article in 2017 in Personal Training Quarterly. Quote, "In order to spot a physical flaw that needs to be corrected, one must begin by having a reliable measure of whether or not it is actually problematic in the first place." Many key scientific studies over the years have undermined major structuralist assumptions. Some of the evidence is direct, some is indirect or circumstantial, as a criminal lawyer would put it. There's a strong pattern of all kinds of evidence converging on the same conclusion. Structuralism does not produce effective therapies. It does not deliver the goods. As Carl Sagan famously pointed out, science delivers the goods, like landing on the moon or curing deadly diseases with antibiotics, which is how we know that science is useful. Treatments and therapies based on structuralism have conspicuously failed to produce obvious benefits for patients. My favorite direct evidence, not the best, but my favorite, has always been the simple leg-length study published way back in 1984 in the venerable British medical journal Lancet. It shows that leg-length differences are unrelated to back pain, no correlation even, let alone a causal relationship. This is a classic and elegant experiment, which found no connection between leg length and back pain. Like most of the really good science experiments, it has that Mythbusters attitude. Why don't we just check that assumption? researchers measured leg lengths, looked for differences in lower limb length and other disproportion at or around the sacroiliac joints, and found no association with back pain. Quote, chronic back pain is thus unlikely to be part of the short leg syndrome. Other studies since have backed this up, but this simple old paper remains a favorite for me. And then there's the fact that minor differences cannot even be reliably diagnosed in the first place. Assessments of leg length are common, both with the patient lying down or standing. Either could be reliable, but in this particular test, and I'm referring to Cooperstein and Lucenta in 2017, in this test, they didn't agree with each other. Two chiropractors with more than 30 years' experience each assessed the same few dozen patients, and agreement between the results when they felt confident in them was perfectly nil. That's a quote, perfectly nil. Despite the widespread and confident use of each method, this test clearly suggests that at least one of them is unreliable, but it's also entirely possible that both of them are. So this is a standard problem with alleged structural problems, not being able to actually diagnose them in the first place, and that's why this section kicked off with that quote from Nick Tumanello. Wear and tear? Not so much. One of the most deeply held beliefs in musculoskeletal medicine is that osteoarthritis is a wear and tear condition, that joints break down under the onslaught of gravity and use. This is a fundamentally mechanical view of arthritis, which directly suggests that the longer we live and the heavier we are, the more likely we are to have joint trouble. But we know that knee osteoarthritis prevalence has doubled in the 20th century, independently of age and weight. So about Wallace et al. From 2017, this is how I summarize that study. Knee osteoarthritis is thought of as a wear and tear problem aggravated by weight and age. In this experiment, that assumption was tested for the first time using long-term historical and evolutionary data. That is, they looked at the skeletal remains of older people with a well-documented body mass index from the last two centuries, industrial and post-industrial, and they also looked at prehistoric knees. The prevalence of osteoarthritis has roughly doubled in recent history, 20th century, and that number didn't change when weight and age were factored out. So the implications are clear. Loading and longer lifespans are not the cause of knee arthritis. The good news? Whatever does drive it could be more preventable than aging. So that study destroys the wear and tear story. Something else is going on. We need to be looking at neurology and immunology to understand why knees, quote-unquote, wear out. Another excellent example of science that flies in the face of structuralism is a failure of the functional movement screen, that's capitalized FMS, that's a brand, the failure of FMS to detect actual recent injuries, let alone any subtle or specific biomechanical risk factors for injury. As mentioned in the intro, FMS is a set of physical tests intended to identify asymmetries and limitations based on the assumption that they're a problem, which is classic structuralism. It's actually hard to imagine anything that could possibly be more structuralist than that. A 2011 study in the International Journal of Sports Physical Therapy found that FMS test results did not change in people who had actually been injured within the last 6 months. If a test can't detect the effect of recent injury on the body or the risk factors that led to it, it probably can't detect future injuries either, and the structuralist assumption at the heart of FMS is therefore rather dubious. I examine more evidence like this in an article all about the FMS for a much more thorough and academic analysis. There's the corrective exercise trap. That's the name of the article that the Nick Tumanello quote came from. The neck is a popular place for biomechanical boogeymen, but in 2007, Grob et al., that's a surname, Grob, published findings in the European Spine Journal that abnormal neck curvatures do not have any connection with neck pain. There's a lot of evidence along this line. This is just, you know, picking one of many examples. There are other experiments that do show a correlation, but never a strong one. The experts can debate the evidence, but it's debatable rather than being a smoking gun. The point is that there is no clear connection between neck curvature and neck pain. How about the shoulder? Shoulder dyskinesis, that's fancy talk for bad shoulder movement, is a very popular biomechanical boogeyman in this area, but there's definitely no smoking gun evidence that funky shoulder movement leads inexorably to pain. By the way, this is exactly the kind of thing that a screening test like the FMS is meant to detect. A 2013 review in the British Journal of Sports Medicine concluded, quote, "No physical examination test of the scapula was found to be useful in differentially diagnosing pathologies of the shoulder." A funny story about the citation for that. In a Facebook discussion, a chiropractor, enthused about shoulder dyskinesis, got annoyed with a physical therapist for calling it a dubious clinical concept. He asked for evidence and linked to a PubMed search, suggesting that the existence of so many papers about it must mean it's legit. That was too good a rebuttal opportunity for me to pass up, a slow pitch right across home plate. Evidence that shoulder dyskinesis is dubious? In those search results, it took me about 10 seconds to find right et al. On the first page. That's the study that I started off citing here. That paper alone is hardly a fatal blow for the validity of shoulder dyskinesis, but it is amusing that the challenge could be answered with such discouraging science that was so easy to find. I mean, basically effortless. Furthermore, while other papers are less obviously negative, none are clearly positive. The literature is only clear about one thing. The clinical significance of shoulder dyskinesis is ambiguous and equivocal at best. Continuing on the shoulder thing, a 2017 British Journal of Sports Medicine paper loudly declared in its title that, quote, "scapular dyskinesis increases the risk of future shoulder pain by 43% in asymptomatic athletes." Yikes! If that's true, that would be exactly the opposite of what I'm trying to say here. But it was a bizarrely misleading headline. Now let's go into a little bit of detail about that. Although the paper's title seems to defy skepticism about the importance of scapular dyskinesia, it is super misleading, and the actual conclusion in the paper is the opposite of what's implied by the title. This is an incredible example of lying with stats. It's only a 43% greater relative risk relative to a small total count of injuries. The difference in absolute risk is super minor. And the authors write in the body of the paper, this is the authors themselves, from the same paper with this title that is shouting one thing, they declare in the paper, screening for scapular dyskinesia is not a useful approach to predict shoulder pain. So pretty much exactly the opposite. So even in a paper with a headline blatantly biased in favor of the importance of structuralism, we end up with the paper's own authors conceding exactly the opposite. Perhaps the knee. A bizarre and amazing study published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2002 showed that a placebo for knee osteoarthritis is just as good as real surgery. A more mechanical problem than rough knee cartilage can hardly be imagined. Yet 150 people who received a sham surgery recovered just as well as people who actually got their cartilage polished. It's hard to imagine a more crushing blow to structuralism than that, except maybe this. A 2010 review of risk factors for the development of knee arthritis after the loss of meniscal tissues mostly eliminated poor knee alignment as a factor. That is Salata et al. In the American Journal of Sports Medicine in 2010, With regards to mechanical knee alignment, Salata et al. Reviewed 7 papers relevant to knee alignment. 3 showed a connection between poor alignment and degeneration, and 4 found none. So the evidence is mixed, but the connection can't be strong if 4 radiographic studies came up empty. Surely poor alignment would definitely spell trouble. That's a common assumption, but it is obviously not a safe one. Numerous MRI studies of the back over the years have shown just terrible correlation between structural problems and back pain. See many studies like Bowden, Jensen, Weishaupt, Stadnick, and Borenstein. Just some of my favorites there. Time after time, you will find that people with low back pain have no detected mechanical problems, and people with detected mechanical problems have no low back pain. That's a topic that I've covered at great length elsewhere, so really just summarizing here. Closely related and more cool, surely narrowing of the spinal canal is always a problem? Perhaps not. Cranking up the counterintuitiveness another notch, scientists found in 2006 that a structural problem that everyone previously assumed to always be painful, even I thought so, turns out not to be. Spinal stenosis has always been regarded as an inevitable cause of back pain, but the archives of physical medicine and rehab has shown clearly that it often does not cause pain after all. In the study, about 150 people were assessed for back pain in different ways, including MRI, but radiologic and clinical impression had no relation. In other words, there was no useful similarity between evaluation of the patient with MRI and evaluation by examination and taking a history. Quote, the impression obtained from an MRI scan doesn't determine whether lumbar stenosis is a cause of pain. Close quote. Since MRI does in fact identify narrowing of the spinal canal, and this is the whole basis of diagnosing spinal stenosis with MRI, these results also strongly imply that a narrowed spinal canal does not alone cause back pain. There has to be some other factor. Hip pain is rarely caused by arthritis, even when the hip joint is clearly arthritic. Most people with signs of arthritis on X-ray do not have any pain, and most people who have hip pain don't have arthritis. That is the finding of a 2015 paper, Kim, Nevitt, and Nui, from the British Medical Journal. It was an analysis of thousands of patients which confirmed this jarring disconnect between signs of arthritis on hip x-rays and hip pain. Quote, hip pain was not present in many hips with radiographic osteoarthritis, and many hips with pain did not show radiographic hip osteoarthritis. Close quote. What they mean by many is actually practically all. Roughly 80% of the patients with signs of arthritis had no pain, and at least 85% of patients with hip pain had no signs of arthritis. These numbers held up even at the extremes. Most older patients with a high suspicion of hip arthritis did not, in fact, have arthritis that could be diagnosed with an X-ray. So, most hip pain is something else. Poor pain degeneration correlation in animals too. Here's an interesting perspective from veterinarian Johnny Bat Yonatan on canine hip dysplasia, an arthritic condition common in big breeds like Labs, German Shepherds, and Rottweilers. He writes, it's a horrendous thing that often leads to the animal having to be euthanized. But the highly specialized grading of hip dysplasia doesn't correlate directly with mobility and life quality. You can have great x-rays of animals that can barely walk, and horrendous hips in dogs that don't display any pain. X-rays sometimes tell a story, other times they're a footnote. We learn early that we need to treat the animal, not the radiograph. Nicely put, and equally apt for pets and their humans. We are all animals. Fang in your throat? Here's a weird example of anti-structuralist evidence. The styloid bone at the back of the throat looks like a fang. Looks like the fang of a saber-toothed squirrel. It can get too long. It can calcify and grow and start to bother the sensitive anatomy around the tip. This is called eagle syndrome. Except, surprisingly, most people with elongated styloids are just fine. Clearly, styloid length is not a hazard in itself. Something else has to be wrong. Next up, if spinal instability were painful, surely stabilizing it would help. But a 2009 study showed that stabilizing fractured vertebrae by injecting bone cement doesn't actually aid the recovery at all. I feel quite close to this finding because I have a wife who had a really badly crushed vertebrae in a car accident in 2010 while she was traveling alone in Asia. So I know some things about crushed and unstable vertebrae. So this is how this evidence came to my attention. Looking at Bookbinder from 2009 in the English Journal of Medicine, sorry, the New England Journal of Medicine, forgot the N. This is it's one of a pair of papers, see also Calmes et al., that presents strong evidence that there's no beneficial effect to stabilizing fractured spines with injections of bone cement, which is a common and yet apparently dubious procedure. And that evidence is backed up by major reviews published since then. But some contrary evidence has also been published, of course, and it's possible that vertebroplasty works better for some kinds of patients. Nevertheless, it is a major comeuppance for a seemingly straightforward surgical fix that should have been tested more carefully long ago. It should be a slam dunk, and it's obviously not. If stabilizing the spine with cement doesn't resolve symptoms of instability, then it strongly suggests that instability wasn't the real or main problem to begin with, or the only problem. More about running risk factors. Pronation is only the most famous of a whole posse of similar biomechanical quirks that supposedly plague runners, including some already mentioned above. Pronation has been so thoroughly debunked by so many experts over the years that I'm just going to skip right over that and talk about the rest in general. Most attempts to confirm running risk injuries fail. In 2004, Devan et al. Published in the Journal of Athletic Training, they couldn't find any connection between knee injuries like IT band syndrome and patellofemoral syndrome, and any of the usual mechanical suspects that are blamed for those conditions. Another paper that year reported, quote, no evidence that static biomechanical alignment measurements of the lower limb are related to lower limb injury, except maybe patellofemoral pain syndrome. In 2009, Ferber et al., who, by the way, do have their own biomechanical theory, concluded that, quote, there is no definitive link between atypical foot mechanics and running injury mechanisms. So they promote one theory while dissing the others. A 2016 study in the European Journal of Sports Science, quote, did not find significant associations, and so on and on. This isn't to say that there are no structural risk factors for running injuries. There are certainly some evidence pointing that way. But whatever associations there are clearly not very clear. Core strength next. This is still assumed to be important by nearly every professional and patient. For instance, in a survey of 600 Irish physiotherapists, we learned that advice and exercise were the treatments most frequently used for chronic low back pain. Advice was most commonly delivered as part of an exercise program, and strengthening, including core stability, was the most frequently prescribed exercise type. And yet, core strengthening has been thoroughly debunked by one experiment after another for 20 years now, roughly. The corset hypothesis is a popular justification for core training, and it's nonsense. Morris et al. In 2011 wrote, quote, these findings indicate that training bilateral preactivation of the transversus abdominis prior to rapid movement is not justified and may potentially be problematic for the production of normal movement patterns. That finding, that study, significantly undermines the classic corset hypothesis idea. No kind of core training has any special power over back pain. It can't produce better results than any other kind of therapeutic exercise, and it does not reduce injury rates. All of this very complicated topic is covered in much greater detail in my low back pain book. One more study, though. One of my favorite examples of core strength research is a 2010 study of more than 1,100 soldiers, which found that specialized, precise core strengthening did little to improve rates of back pain or any other injury, compared to good old-fashioned sit-ups. Meanwhile, many other studies show that no kind of core strengthening is important. Structuralism is at its most insidious with core strengthening. The industry tends to put on airs and act like it's vital not only that you do core training, but that you do it in a special, technical way for just the right patients, that is, expertly customized. That's always the implication. It's one of the main reasons to pay a physical therapist. The patient believes or hopes that there must be some reason for paying $100 an hour rather than just doing sit-ups at home. Childs et al. Undermined core strengthening dogma by showing that it just doesn't matter how technical your core strengthening is. Continuing with back pain, but now talking about massage for low back pain. A large 2011 study of massage for back pain tested the effectiveness of a structural style of massage. That was their word. They called it structural massage, and it consisted of a blend of popular techniques and treatment approaches based on common structuralist assumptions. It was a bit vague. It wasn't very precisely defined, but it was definitely massage for structuralists. Massage therapists are prone to believing that the right moves will have a more profound therapeutic effect than just ordinary touching. So in this study, moderately trained therapists with more than 5 years of experience provided about 130 patients with 10 hours of this kind of special structural massage. They also gave ordinary relaxation Swedish massage to another 130 patients. So pretty good head-to-head comparison. The effects on back pain of these two approaches were carefully measured over an entire year, so not only a pretty decent size, but also pretty long term. And the results were revealing and predictable, because I'm citing them here. There was no clinically meaningful difference between relaxation and structural massage. Their words, nothing. No clinically meaningful difference. That's quite an embarrassing outcome for techniques that are routinely touted as advanced. If structuralism were a good basis for massage technique, it should have produced impressively superior results, yeah? But no, not even a small clear improvement, just the same as good old-fashioned Swedish massage. Muscle imbalances now. This is another classic biomechanical boogeyman. Asymmetrically under- and overdeveloped muscles are nearly always demonized as sources of stress and strain that are inherently painful and boost the risk of injury. They're also often rather poorly defined, I might add. There are many examples of uneven muscle mass in serious athletes, but none are confirmed causes of pain or risk factors for injury, like imbalanced back muscles of pro footballers. Hides et al. In 2010. Researchers used MRI to measure the size of kicking muscles in 54 Australian Football League players. These are very serious athletes, these guys, playing a very rough sport. First, the authors proved that they have major muscle imbalances, bigger kicking muscles on one side, imagine that. And then they proved that they were, quote, not related to the number of injuries in those athletes. I repeat, not related. So this is obviously exactly the opposite of what any good structuralist would predict. And given the roughness of the sport, maybe it's to be expected that injuries would be more related to collisions and less related to muscle asymmetries. Perhaps so. However, these athletes are likely to have been training heavily off the field as well, and structuralists would argue that muscle asymmetry creates a vulnerability to injury which should show up in any sport if they're correct. And it didn't here. Asymmetric atrophy is easier to demonize, much easier, but there's good evidence that it's both common and harmless in tennis players. So, next study. Young et al. In 2015, this odd little study reported a pattern of infraspinatus atrophy in the shoulders of elite female tennis players. The infraspinatus is one of the four little rotator cuff muscles that control fine movement of the shoulder joint. Such atrophy, it turns out, is common in overhead athletes, but it doesn't appear to be a problem. In these tennis players, atrophy correlated with better performance, not worse, and had no association with any shoulder problems. This appears to be a muscle imbalance that's actually a good thing, something about elite performance in tennis that actually requires or causes it. So obviously it would be a mistake for a massage therapist to compare sides in such athletes, which is a common procedure at the beginning of massage appointments. The massage therapist gets you standing up straight and looks at both sides and makes much ado about any difference from side to side in many cases. It would be a mistake to do that and start trying to restore balance in athletes like this. I suspect that is a mistake that most massage therapists would make despite this evidence because they aren't aware of this evidence. Okay, that's it for this very long section. It's not a complete list of relevant science, just a bunch of my favorites. My personal experience in studying the subject for the last several years, many years now, really more than a decade, is that I can hardly look up anything anymore without finding more evidence that structuralism is just a lousy way of explaining people's pain. Disclaimer: structure is not completely irrelevant, obviously. It's probably too late in the article for this. I probably should have made it clearer sooner. But an important part of the case against structuralism is that it's not absolutist. It's very easy for me to argue that structuralism matters less than expected. It would be impossible to argue that structure never matters because that's just crazy. Of course, biomechanics do matter sometimes. 1,000 times, yes, nothing is black or white in this business. Ask anyone who's ruptured a tendon. Some problems are obviously firmly rooted in structural troubles. A good scientific example of this is a pair of 2015 studies, both published by the same researchers. The first study pushes away from structuralism, and the second back towards it. These folks looked at a lot of MRI pictures of spines. Their first paper presented evidence that signs of spinal degeneration are present in a very high percentage of healthy people with no problem at all. That is, no pain. These are not patients. These are not people who need help. And yet, they've got degeneration clearly visible on their MRIs. This is good to know, and that's the kind of evidence that I presented a whole bunch of in the last section. I could easily have cited it there. But the second paper presents evidence that degenerative features visible on MRI are nevertheless, quote, more prevalent in adults 50 years of age or younger with back pain compared to asymptomatic individuals. Also very good to know. So what do we do with this delicious cognitive dissonance? The take-home message is actually just a nice, reasonable compromise between the two well-known viewpoints or ends of the spectrum. Degenerative changes matter less than many patients and professionals still assume, and they're not an adequate foundation for many popular treatments, but they do still matter. Duh. The rest of the section is a couple of examples. I'm going to start with clunial entrapment, a perfect example of a structural problem. Or is it? This example is delightfully ambiguous, which makes it perfect. Nothing is entirely structural, and that's the problem with overemphasizing it. But some things are quite structural, like clunial nerve impingement, a cause of back pain that may be non-rare and probably usually evades diagnosis. The clunial nerves pass from the low back and the sacrum into the buttocks, just under the skin, and they can get tangled up with ligaments and connective tissue on their way, potentially causing very low back pain. In 2016, AOTA, that's a name, A-O-T-A, AOTA, reported on, quote, a case of severe low back pain, which was completely treated by release of the middle clunial nerve. Exploratory surgery identified nerves entrapped in adhesions. They cut them free, and that was the ticket. The patient was decisively cured, which is pretty cool. Now that seems like about as structural a problem as we can imagine. tissue in trouble, as physical as tangled sailboat rigging. And yet, it is still possible that her problem was not the nerve snag, per se, but a biological vulnerability to feeling it. The physical predicament of the nerve may have been like kindling for a fire that was then lit by something else, and which then burned for years. So what else? What else would light the fire? Biological X factors, non-structural problems, biochemistry, nutrition, cellular business. Maybe she was vulnerable to that clunial nerve impingement because of a vitamin D or magnesium deficiency or a medication side effect. The biological consequences of sleep deprivation or sleep apnea. Blood gases get quite weird with that condition. Or the chronic stress of social isolation or inflammaging, the inflammation that inevitably comes with aging. Or any one of about 10,000 other possibilities, the list of could-bes is almost literally endless. So in this scenario, the nerve entrapment is like kindling for a fire, just inert fuel by itself. That doesn't mean it's not a problem. You don't really want fuel for chronic pain lying around your body just waiting for you to get vulnerable enough for it to burst into flame. But you also don't blame fuel for a fire, or not just the fuel, anyway. This is all speculation, of course. It would be difficult to prove causation for even a single example, let alone a whole class of potential vulnerabilities. But I think it's one plausible explanation for one of the most difficult puzzles in pain science, which is why obvious physical problems have such inconsistent consequences. The other big one is, of course, the psychosocial dimension of pain. But even if we could know that it was the vulnerability and not the entrapment, and that would certainly be fascinating to know, diagnosing the vulnerability and solving it could well be a lot trickier than just setting the nerve free. No kindling, no fire. Mostly this problem seems as straightforwardly mechanical as your legs falling asleep because a 40-pound terrier won't get off your lap. Okay, the next example. The tough lumbar joints of ladies. It is an anatomical fact that women have larger, stronger posterior lumbar joints, and that is almost certainly a biomechanical feature that has evolved to cope with the combined stresses of pregnancy, the large, awkwardly off-center weight and leaning backwards to keep from falling over. This strongly suggests that women with weaker spines over the aeons often failed to carry their babies to term because the strain was debilitating. What are the odds that this evolutionary adaptation makes women immune to the back strain caused by pregnancy? Well, nil. Even today, even with tougher spines, pregnant women suffer increased rates of low back pain. What we take from this is that the importance of spinal curvature is moderated by evolution. We can clearly see that the deviations from normal spinal curvature are a factor in back pain, or women would never have evolved an adaptation to cope with it. On the other hand, the same adaptation pretty clearly shows that both men and women are probably adapted enough that spinal curvature alone cannot be a deal breaker. If it were a deal breaker, we would have evolved to cope with it. So another way of putting that, evolution doesn't care if you have back pain, just as long as you can still breed. But it always makes sure that you can do at least that much. Thank you, evolution. It is easy for nature to saddle us with biomechanical features that are uncomfortable and imperfect, but at the same time, we're mostly well protected for biomechanical features that are crippling. And so, biomechanical factors are usually much less important than generally supposed. Structuralists are not all wrong or always wrong, of course. Some biomechanical boogeymen truly are scary, and there are times for a structural diagnosis and a structural solution. Some problems are clearly more mechanical in nature than others, and the menisci in the knee are a great example of a high-functioning but vulnerable evolutionary compromise. Those menisci do great things for us. They make our knees work much better, but they also fail quite a bit with clearly crappy consequences. And yet, even for that, the clinical importance of meniscal fraying and tearing is cast into doubt by studies showing that repair is surprisingly ineffective. There is a broad scientific consensus that meniscectomy is useless and risky for most patients. It produces results no better than a fake surgery or exercise therapy. Severe cases probably benefit more, but no one's actually tested that yet, and we could be surprised by the results when they finally do. Mechanical problems with conceptually simple mechanical solutions are amazingly rare. While structure does matter sometimes, the evidence overall guides us away from getting our knickers in a collective knot over most of the popular structuralist ideas about pain and injury. Jason Silvernail's epic and widely quoted rebuttal to accusations that we're throwing the biomechanics baby out with the bathwater. My argument is that biomechanics should be de-emphasized, not ignored. But structuralists are so invested in their perspective that they often react with fierce defensiveness to this article and all similar arguments elsewhere. They attack the argument by misrepresenting it, and almost always in the same way. They say that I'm claiming biomechanics don't matter at all, or that I'm throwing the baby out with the bathwater, or both. It's a blatant strawman argument, attacking an opinion I don't actually have, and it gets really tiresome. And I'm not the only one who's gotten tired of it. Jason Silvernail, a particularly expert and articulate physical therapist, has also gotten, quote, really sick to death of this particular canned response. In 2013, he spontaneously wrote this epic rebuttal, which has been quoted ad infinitum by many like-minded colleagues ever since, and it now gets invoked almost every time that straw man shows its face. Here it is in full, it's a few paragraphs. Every time pain science gets discussed, there are always people who push back, and it's nearly always, acknowledged or not, the straw man of biomechanics doesn't matter. No one has said that biomechanics doesn't matter. Mechanical origin pain by its nature is biomechanical, and the concepts of neurodynamics are also. The problem is that people have been trained to think things like pelvic tilt and core weakness and short muscles are significant biomechanical problems that must be creating a large nociceptive drive, that therefore pain science discussions ignore nociceptive pain. But we need to put biomechanics in its place, not out of our mind, when thinking about pain. We need to start to question closely our clinical reasoning processes and realize that not every impairment to movement or function is equally contributing to a pain experience, and many may be irrelevant. We discover which ones are relevant and worth correcting through a systematic assessment and reasoning process. Two of the most common and most supported by randomized controlled trials are the McKenzie MDT system and the Maitland Manual Therapy system. What we don't do is assume that every kind of positional movement, muscle length or strength, nerve mobility, or joint accessory movement impairment is contributing equally to nociceptive drive, and that they all need to be addressed, and that acknowledging the published research evidence that many of these impairments are normal findings unrelated to the pain experience is somehow, quote, ignoring biomechanics. It's a testament to how indoctrinated people are into the biomedical model that their concept of pain begins and ends with their ability to find things to blame and fix in the patient's body. I, for one, won't apologize for trying to move people in the fitness and rehab world away from such a simplistic, practitioner-centered, outdated view to a more complex, patient-centered, and modern view of the pain experience. If people want to say that means ignoring biomechanics, well, we will just have to keep pointing out this strawman argument when we see it. But I am really sick to death of this particular canned response. So again, that is Doctor of Physical Therapy, Jason Silvernail. And he posted that on the famous forum for wonks of musculoskeletal medicine, Soma Simple. And the post was titled, "That Grinds My Gears, You Say Biomechanics Doesn't Matter." The journal Manual Therapy doesn't want to be about manual therapy anymore. This is a very short section devoted to a small news item, but I think it's such a significant one that it deserves the focus First of all, a reminder that manual therapy refers to methods of trying to treat pain and facilitate recovery from injury with bare hands, especially massage and chiropractic, but also physiotherapy to a great extent. There are literally hundreds of specific examples of manual therapies, and most of them, by nature, assume the existence of tissue glitches that they are intended to correct. In other words, most of them are inherently structuralist in character. So the former Journal of Manual Therapy was all about that stuff. But then, in 2017, the journal changed its name to Musculoskeletal Science and Practice. Their understated explanation for the change, quote, "The new title will better reflect current practice, education, and research in the field of musculoskeletal physiotherapy worldwide, and ensure that the journal continues to be a leading publication in the field." In other words, manual therapy was just too narrow, too much about fixing people with techniques and magic hands, and neglected other perspectives and approaches. The change signaled a general retreat from the belief that flesh and structure need to be changed, or even can be. It's writing on the wall that says that manual therapy needs to get beyond being manual, because there's a lot more to this field than structure. Structuralists everywhere. There is a flavor of structuralism for every degree of gullibility, I'm afraid. Upper cervical chiropractors, that's also known as NUCCA chiropractors, that's an acronym, N-U-C-C-A. They believe that many, if not most, health problems not only originate solely from dysfunction of the topmost spinal joint, but that they have the skill to reliably correct all of these problems just by manipulating that joint. This is a classic, extraordinary claim, hard for many people to swallow, but there is still clearly a market for the service. Many patients are charmed by such an elegant-seeming explanation for everything that's ever gone wrong with them. Savvier patients are still likely to fall hook, line, and sinker for exactly the same kind of thinking when they encounter a tamer form of it in a massage therapist's office. A short leg diagnosis certainly sounds like a plausible explanation for back pain to a lot of people. Only the most cynical patients will dismiss it. Many patients have complained to me about this diagnosis, but only usually because they simply failed to get any benefit from buying expensive therapy for it, not because they were actually aware of any problem with the idea itself. Many hardened skeptics will happily swallow a dubious structural diagnosis if it comes from a doctor reviewing an MRI report. Indeed, they'll probably swallow it because it comes from a doctor reviewing an MRI report. High-tech medicine is persuasive. Unfortunately, the source doesn't make it any more true, and countless studies have now shown how misleading MRI can be, how often it reveals harmless structural features and abnormalities that get blown way out of proportion by naive doctors who are just as keen on an easy explanation as the patient is. Structuralism is immune to credentials. Everyone's got the disease of structuralism, both alternative health professionals as well as defenders of the mainstream alike. Dramatis personae, structuralism in different professions. It's important to understand that there is not really any particular reason for us to believe that we will easily find good advice about aches, pains, and injuries. Unfortunately, most patients seeking care for a knee problem or a shoulder problem don't realize at first that it may be surprisingly difficult to get good help. If their problem proves to be a stubborn one, it can take several months or even years to get more cynical and savvy. Along the way, they invariably encounter a lot of structuralism, which they slowly but surely become more suspicious of, and yet they will lack the expertise to effectively challenge it. In the following section, I'll try to address the question of how common structuralism really is. Spoiler alert, it's super common. And in this section, I'll talk about specific healthcare professionals and their relationship to structuralism. I once worked with a back pain client who'd seen at least 24 structuralists over a period of 5 years. Literally every healthcare professional he had seen was a dyed-in-the-wool structuralist, and his mind was quite polluted with their theories. He could hardly open his mouth without saying something about his alleged biomechanical problems. Predictably, there was no agreement between the various diagnoses. Everyone had diagnosed a different biomechanical boogeyman. What a mess. So I was thrilled to hear that he had just started seeing a new doctor who was, like me, telling him to stop worrying about biomechanics. But it took this patient 5 years of searching to find just two non-structuralists. We were the first that he'd ever encountered. Family doctors have a proven poor track record in these matters. Musculoskeletal medicine, that is. They really know quite little. And so they fall into the mental convenience of structuralism very easily because they've just never really thought about it one way or the other. They are not experts in this. And orthopedic surgeons are appropriately preoccupied with building their surgical expertise, and so their knowledge is quite naturally slanted towards structuralism as well. Chiropractors are structuralists pretty much by definition. The profession exists to adjust alleged biomechanical problems with the spine and other joints. Physical therapists, physiotherapists in Canada and much of the rest of the world, are notorious for their preoccupation with mechanics of the body. I believe that they have fallen into this trap because they do not have a clear defining methodology. Massage therapists massage, chiropractors crack, surgeons cut. But what do physiotherapists do? They are generalists, cherry-picking from a wide variety of therapies, such as strengthening exercises or ultrasound treatment. This is both an obvious strength and a weakness. I've often had the impression that physiotherapists quite literally focus on structuralism because it gives them something to do, something to diagnose, something to therapize, a nice clear theme for their clinical choices. Massage therapists are not well trained in most jurisdictions, and even where training standards are higher, they barely scratch the surface of rehabilitation science, and so they tend to fall into structuralism because they lack the education they need to deconstruct it. And embracing it is the easiest way for them to feel more competent. For instance, diagnosing and treating postural dysfunction is an easy way to sound like you're providing medical massage. The unfortunate reality is that most massage therapists, although their work may produce many minor benefits, simply do not have the academic chops to even try to explain complex musculoskeletal problems. The most relevant medical specialists, sports medicine doctors, doctors of physical medicine and rehabilitation or PMNR, physiatrists, and orthopedic surgeons. These are all the most likely source of competent medical help for aches, pains, and injuries. They're the best trained and the most likely to be keeping up with the science. But there are caveats. Their practices are often dominated by major traumatic injuries, knees that are blown in football games, that kind of thing. Orthopedic surgeons in particular are appropriately preoccupied with these severe cases and building their surgical expertise, and so their knowledge is quite naturally slanted towards structuralism. All of these specialties provide invaluable services to people who are concretely and/or severely injured, but they may be just as out of their depth as your family doc with any of the quote-unquote minor problems that often plague people. They may dismiss such problems as trivial, and/or they may humbly recognize that they simply don't know what to do with them. Chronic overuse injuries that just won't go away, back pain that comes and goes mysteriously for years, severe neck cricks. These kinds of things are common problems, yet they're also considered problem cases by most of these specialists. I often see patients with these problems who have been to see two or three specialists, all of whom were basically stumped. They tossed out a few structuralist explanations. Well, it's probably got something to do with your core strength. Let's get you to the gym. And then they seem to lose interest. Who does that leave? What kind of professional is likely to look for explanations that are more complex and less satisfying than the easy but often incorrect answers of structuralism? Well, the sad, ugly truth, no kind of professional. There just is no such critter. You simply have to find an individual professional who cares, someone who's a determined, humble, and open-minded troubleshooter, someone who isn't obsessed with structuralism. And that is a tall order. How many professionals really are structuralists? A common complaint about this article is that I make a straw man argument, a case against an imaginary kind of professional. Hardly anyone is actually a structuralist, the argument goes, and no good professional really exaggerates the importance of biomechanical factors. This complaint is exemplified by this comment on the topic from Leon Chaitel. Quote, no remotely intelligent practitioner or therapist actually believes that all pain and dysfunction is caused by structural features alone. This is hardly a balanced approach. Ignoring biomechanics, posture, and structure would therefore be as ludicrous as suggesting that back pain or other was solely due to biomechanical factors. End quote. Indeed, it would, but unfortunately, I've seen a lot more lip service to the idea of a balanced approach than a genuinely balanced approach. Professor Gordon Waddell is a low back pain expert and one of the pioneers of alternatives to structuralism, and he was writing about treating patients rather than spines way back in the 80s. Quote, it's all very well to say that we use science and mechanical treatment within a holistic framework, but it's too easy for that framework to dissolve in the starry mists of idealism. We all agree in principle that we should treat people and not spines, but then, in daily practice, we get on with the business of mechanics. Again, that was Dr. Gordon Waddell. That's from his book, The Back Pain Revolution, in 1998. This topic is highly controversial and has sparked heated debates in every possible context, from scientific journals to Facebook. Most of the social media kerfuffles that I've seen, and I've seen hundreds of them now, have been fights about the validity of one structuralist sacred cow or another. Numbers are impossible without some research that won't ever be done. But my experience strongly suggests that structuralism is not only common, but still the dominant way of thinking about musculoskeletal pain. And I am hardly alone in that opinion. Here's a supportive reader report from a physiotherapist in the UK. Quote, Letterman's The Myth of Core Stability has been available on our physiotherapy website for years, and yet I still hear the same old core stability nonsense churned out on a daily basis. My biggest gripe is why the universities, over here in England anyway, keep on teaching the same old syllabus and don't evolve their courses in line with current evidence. There's still a huge emphasis on passive treatments and different ways in which we can fix our patients. It's scary. And until we start to produce physios with a different schooling and a different mindset, unfortunately, I can't see there being much of a paradigm shift in the near or distant future. That's Pete Gray, a physiotherapist from Nottingham. Maybe there are significant differences between professions in different parts of the world, but here in my own backyard in Canada and damn near everywhere else, as suggested by a decade of constant substantive correspondence with patients and professionals around the world, structural and biomechanical factors generally reign supreme, routinely emphasized by manual therapists to the near exclusion of most other clinical considerations. I have seen a never-ending parade of clients with biomechanical past diagnoses, but almost never seen a patient who said, well, the last guy emphasized cycles, social factors, and central sensitization, which should be the rule, not the vanishingly rare exception. Instead, while many non-biomechanical factors in chronic pain may be paid some lip service, they are rarely or barely used to actually guide clinical choices. Merely mentioning them doesn't constitute useful application of the evidence to a patient's difficult situation. Few clinicians seem to be aware of that evidence. Fewer still seem to know what to do with it. And so they continue to strongly favor biomechanical factors because it's familiar and easy. I'm even guilty of overemphasizing structural factors, despite years of denouncing structuralism. I know exactly how tempting a perspective it is. I was originally taught to treat people with my hands, and I still tend to think like a sculptor of flesh, a meat repair man, regardless of whether or not that actually makes any sense. I strain to prevent that way of thinking from invading my mind, but I have often failed. I've often made the error of fixating on that which is more concrete, easier to hold in my mind, easier to explain to patients, easier to chase with my hands. You can't grab and adjust the subtle factors that drive most so-called mechanical pain, like stress and insomnia, addiction, inflammaging and metabolic syndrome, or a subtle pathology of connective tissue. And so, most health professionals have a strong and understandable mental predisposition to structuralism. Mind your words. Here's a fine rant from Norwegian physical therapist Sigurd Mikkelsen about an all too typical clinical experience with structuralism coming from a sports doc. And please note, the harsh language here is not a transcript of his actual clinical communication with the client, but a frustrated description amongst colleagues of how he felt about it. Things that piss me off. First consultation today, a young, active girl with an ACL injury. She got told by the doctor that she'd never play football again after looking for about 2 seconds on her MRI, which instantly scared the shit out of her, and all her dreams about sports and becoming a policewoman were brutally shattered. She cried out of relief when I told her that this doc should go fuck the hell off and told her how Hjutil Jansrud won Olympic gold in Super G 1 year after his ACL injury, then went off with a 15-minute continuous heroic rant about how fucking fantastic and adaptable our bodies and minds are, and threw around stories about great comebacks and insane human achievements. She felt better when she left the office. For fuck's sakes, mind your words. They can change lives forever. So I hear stories like that on a daily basis, and I have for my whole career. Patients are constantly told depressing, scary, bogus things about their injuries based on a shallow examination and the pernicious belief that we're like fragile machines as opposed to freakishly resilient biological marvels, which is far closer to the truth. My inbox is full of this, like it's coming from a fire hose, and that's why I get so exasperated when I get "don't throw the baby out with the bathwater" reactions every time that I try to swing the clinical reasoning pendulum a little away from structuralism and fragilistic thinking. The pendulum has never even come close to descending to a balance point between a biomechanical perspective on musculoskeletal medicine versus a neuro and biological perspective, let alone actually swinging too far in the other direction. Ooh, dots! The mystique of connecting the biomechanical dots. One particularly insidious subspecies of structuralism involves elaborate dot-connecting theories. Most structuralism takes the form of straightforward causes, like a narrowed spinal canal causes back pain. It doesn't, not inevitably. Structuralism tends to be presented this way, even when the biomechanics are obviously not that simple. But professionals who really embrace structuralism like to connect the dots, the better to impress their patients. For instance, a podiatrist might tell you that your fallen arches, dot, cause greater strain in your knees, dot, which in turn forces you to use your hips differently, dot, which leads to hip weakness, dot, then muscle imbalance in the core, dot, which finally results in back pain, dot. The best dot connectors can be quite convincing, painting elaborate pictures of interconnectedness and inviting you to share a wise chuckle about how everything really is connected. Indeed, the foot bone really is connected to the leg bone, and so on. That these kinds of more complex biomechanical relationships exist is not in question. They do. The trouble is that they are hopelessly complex, effectively impossible to interpret reliably, extremely difficult to treat, and above all, simply not all that important. Recall that we have already demonstrated that even simple biomechanical relationships do not correlate well with pain. A narrow spinal canal does not predict stenotic back pain. Many people with IT band syndrome do not have a tight IT band, and so on. Even the most direct relationships tend to defy common sense. The relationships exist, but it turns out that they are fiendishly hard to understand. Every time you add another link in the chain of reasoning between a symptom and its proposed cause, then you increase the complexity and the chance of error exponentially. Considering that therapists often cannot even agree on the existence or clinical significance of a single factor, what are the odds that they're going to agree on the causal relationships between three or more of them chained together? Therapists use dot-connecting structuralism to impress their patients and themselves. The dot-connecting thing is usually inextricably connected with an ego trip. I explore this more thoroughly in the article The Humble Therapist. You can get to that at painscience.com/humble. Why we love to love structuralism, an explanation in search of a phenomenon. Why are patients so tolerant of structuralism? Why do they so consistently believe something that's so easy to disprove, something that doesn't even produce results? Because it's human nature to believe whatever feels good, and structuralism feels good for both patients and professionals, mainly because we love the superficial simplicity of it. Simplicity is just satisfying and more compatible with optimism. Simple problems are fixable problems. Although the messiness of biology should have cured us of it by now, we still tend to think of our bodies as unusually complicated machines, and structuralism plugs right into that. Of course, many structuralist theories aren't necessarily simple in their details, and they may even involve elaborate dot connecting, but they all basically boil down to something that we can tell people the next day at the water cooler. My pelvis is out of whack. So easy. And so much better if we can impress upon our audience that our clever therapist was able to trace the causal pathway through 9 intermediate misalignments. But it's still a simple explanation in essence. But the body is assuredly not just a complicated machine. It's an absurdly complex and ongoing evolutionary experiment in organic chemistry. Mechanical imagery is almost completely useless as a way to achieve a good understanding of musculoskeletal health. By analogy, doctors have learned that there is a great deal more to an obstructed artery than clogging. Instead, it involves a bewildering array of biochemistry mediated by countless factors, more complex than anyone dared to dream of just 100 years ago. Similarly, therapists must get past mechanics. Joints may be like hinges in a superficial way, but they are not hinges, work nothing like hinges, fail nothing like hinges, and heal nothing like hinges. Yet, structuralism is a rather transparent and pathetic attempt to explain pain as a mechanical breakdown, described in terms that are indeed quite simplistic compared to the breathtakingly complex reality that is your tissues. The seductiveness of believing what feels good is extremely potent, not to be underestimated. Given the choice to believe in something that feels good but is wrong, and something that is true but disconcerting, the human animal will go with feels good almost every time. This tends to result in the proliferation of every imaginable kind of product, service, and scam that appeals to our desires. We actually do constantly spend time and energy and money on solutions that don't work, whether it's a kitchen widget, a stock tip, or physical therapy. Knowing what we all know about human nature, it would be amazing if we weren't collectively prone to excessive optimism about healthcare theories. Carl Sagan's book, the classic Demon-Haunted World, thoroughly and brilliantly illuminates this principle of human nature, giving countless examples of how belief and gullibility is driven by our craving to live in our comfort zones. When we believe something makes sense, we can spend a long time stubbornly looking for evidence that we're correct, even when we can't find any. Our comeuppances can be delayed for years, even entire lives, by the tendency to misinterpret the evidence in our favor. But let me tell you how that path ends for the intellectually honest professional, because I've been doing this job long enough now to have read a great deal of science, vastly more than the average clinician will ever have time for. And there's simply nothing there to support structuralism as a useful way of thinking about pain and injury. After decades of trying, researchers still can't actually find the phenomena that they obviously think must exist for structural explanations of pain to work. And meanwhile, clinicians keep repeating the mechanical explanations. Posture, structure, and biomechanics have had their day in the research sun. They've had their chance to make a difference. We've wrung almost as much explanatory power and clinical relevance out of that paradigm as we're ever going to. The returns on our research investment started diminishing long ago, and we're scraping the bottom of the barrel now. Meanwhile, overuse injuries and chronic pain march on, just as nasty as ever before, and probably much worse. It's time to move on to new ways of explaining and treating pain. So, now what? Some alternatives to structuralism for manual therapists. I have received many cranky complaints over the years about this article, most of them calling me out for being too negative and failing to provide alternatives to structuralism. Well, it's not my responsibility to tell professionals what should replace a failed conceptual model. It's a big enough job just making the case that the Emperor has no clothes. It is not feasible for me to also pick out a new wardrobe for him to wear tomorrow, and even if I could, it wouldn't make him any less naked today. But what if nothing in particular can replace structuralism? The naked truth is important on its own, no matter how depressing. Fortunately, I think there are good alternatives to structuralism. Even obvious ones. I spent at least the last few years of my own career as a busy massage therapist, helping people every day, but only occasionally motivated by structuralism. It didn't feel difficult. If anything, it actually felt easier and more honest than constantly fine-tuning elaborate biomechanical rationalizations for what I was doing, which never felt done because they couldn't be. Prescriptions for pros, how to move on from structuralism. This is my basic prescription for a non-structuralist approach to helping people recover from injuries and chronic pain. Avoid causing pain and generating nocebos. Create novel and pleasant sensations. Treat chronic pain more like other chronic illnesses. And be an expert guide and an encouraging coach. You'd think that avoiding causing pain would be obvious, but it really does need to be said. Most physical and manipulative therapy, for at least a quarter century now, has had the same basic goal, to alter the state of peripheral tissues, because of the guiding principle that there must be something wrong with those tissues, something in need of fixing. Much of that work is done in vain, because there's rarely anything wrong, at least rarely anything wrong that can actually be fixed. And yet, repair is often attempted at the cost of a bunch of caustic sensory input, because it turns out that trying to fix flesh often involves uncomfortable, forceful tactics, like a wide variety of intense massage, most dramatically scraping with hard tools, high-velocity joint adjustments, stabbing sore spots with needles, dry needling, and so on and on. Luckily for patients, their brains usually interpret those sensations as good for me, no pain, no gain. They hope and they assume that they're safe, and so surprisingly little harm is done, and sometimes even some good, albeit largely accidental good. But there are also many exceptions. Some people are downright traumatized by the tough love of intense meat-mangling therapy. It's not common, but it should be completely unheard of. The main problem with the focus on tissue fixing is usually just a missed opportunity to do other, better things. So here's my prescription in some more detail. First, at all costs, avoid doing harm with harsh sensory input in the name of therapy. Also avoid doing harm with nocebo. Give people neurologically sound reasons to be hopeful instead of biomechanical boogeymen to be worried about. Second, start trying to interact with nervous systems instead of fixing flesh. Creatively generate pleasant, interesting, and/or useful sensory experiences. Third, treat chronic pain more like other chronic illnesses. That is, work on a strong relationship with patients, coach and teach, encourage exercise, troubleshoot critical lifestyle factors like insomnia, smoking, anxiety, etc. And fourth, for all problems, new unexplained pain, chronic pain, injury rehab, embrace your role as a knowledgeable guide through the maze of theories and possibilities. Learn as much as possible about pain neurology and physiology and then pass it on. Empower patients to save themselves because you actually can't. but you can teach. You can train patients how to minimize and eliminate aggravating factors and other impediments to recovery, which is all healing ever really is. But above all, explain pain, because pain is weird and it needs explaining badly. None of this approach is properly evidence-based. I can't point to studies that show that therapists who work this way produce better results for their patients. There's a buttload of indirect and circumstantial evidence that it's well worth trying, but definitely no clear evidence of efficacy, which is a shame, but totally unsurprising at this point in history. On the bright side, this methodology also hasn't actually been undermined by evidence the way structuralism has. And it definitely has something structuralism never had: plausibility, based on an improved understanding of how aches and pains actually work. Plus a strong do-no-harm theme. In search of practical solutions. Many professionals chafe at the lack of, quote, something practical that can be implemented, as one reader put it. That desire is understandable, but it's also nearly impossible to satisfy. The biggest problem in manual therapy is over-reliance on the practical. Modalities, techniques, methods, tools for the toolbox. Most of these exist because they are marketable, appealing solutions to problems that are exaggerated, if not downright imaginary. Wiser, more nuanced, and complex ideas about how to help people with chronic pain, which are the only kind of ideas that actually matter, are always competing with and being overshadowed by more practical approaches that are almost literally designed to sound more promising. The market has been given so many of these practical, promising options for so long that anything more realistic and nuanced is inevitably going to seem vexingly inaccessible and abstract by comparison. Greg Lehman's Fundamentals of Treatment. Another non-structuralist treatment model that I like is Greg Lehman's Fundamentals of Treatment, also known as the Axioms of Function, which he describes in detail in his article called Don't Freak Out. All of these are great points, but number 4 is particularly relevant here. 1. Rule out red flags, of course. 2. Rule out serious tissue pathology, very closely related to 1. 3. The body is strong and adaptable. 4. The important one, pain is more about sensitivity than it is about injury. 5. Treatment is about finding the appropriate stressor. 6. The patient is an active participant in their own care. And finally, 7. A collection of decorations, quote, useful though not fundamental axioms, according to Greg. Gauge your treatments by assessing sensitivity. Manual therapy is an adjunct to fundamentals. Your assessment reinforces their belief in strength. Comprehensive capacity trumps assessment-driven correctives. Postural and movement assessments reveal habits, but not flaws. I think this model does a great job of taming excessive structuralism without throwing it out entirely, which is classic Lehman. He teaches a terrific course called Reconciling Biomechanics with Pain Science.